so far, we've looked at Bonhoeffer, Deborah, Moses, and David. I think that's right. If you've missed any of them, do take a look at the website, listen on the podcast, that would be great. But basically, Hebrews 11, it's this famous chapter which tells the story of person after person after person who lived by faith, heroes of the Old Testament, who through whom God wove his sovereign plan. And basically what we want to do in these few weeks over the summer is take a look back at their lives that they would inspire us to live a life of faith in our lives today. And today, I want us to look at someone that, on first glance, might be a bit of a surprising choice to be classed as a hero. She wasn't a king or queen, no leader or prophet among the people of Israel. In fact, unlike David or Deborah, Moses and Gideon, it's not actually a story about the people of Israel. It's not a big picture story of God choosing a man or woman to be his instrument of salvation. There's no slaying of Goliath. There's no confronting the prophets of Baal, no lion's den, no burning bushes, no angelic visitations. In fact, the biblical author zooms into one family, and in particular, one surprising woman of faith whose story has been loved and cherished among Jewish and Christian writings for hundreds of years. And you can find her story in the book of Ruth. There is the clue. You've now got it. If you want to flick to that book, then please do so. It's a tiny book in between the books of Judges and Samuel. Hopefully that will help you find it. And just to say, if you're here and you're just working out what you think about Jesus and you haven't got a Bible, please do take one of the Bibles that are here. We would love to give that to you as a gift, and do read it. That would be great. So, Ruth. Ruth is a beautiful story. It's tragic at points, it's deeply romantic, and it's a story of incredible redemption, a story that goes from tragedy to security, from bitterness to hope, from poverty to provision. And it's centered on two women. You've got Naomi, who's this older woman, she's an Israelite, and you've got Ruth, who is her daughter-in-law. She's a younger woman, and she's from the land of Moab. She's a Moabitess. She is a foreigner. She lives outside of the people of a people of God. And the story is set in the period of history where the judges led the Israelites. So you've had Joshua has actually brought the Israelites into the land of Canaan. They've got their promised inheritance of a land of their own as the people of Israel. And yet then there's this quite traumatic period where nations are attacking them, and it's unstable, and there's threat, and they're attacked by surrounding nations. A time, and it's summarized by a verse in Judges which says, "In those days Israel had no king. The people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes." Now, I would love, and I was tempted, to read you the whole story, but I thought that might be a bit too over-optimistic. So I'm going to try and summarize it for you as quickly as possible. But basically, the story starts with a famine in Israel. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, takes his wife, Naomi, and their sons, and they leave Bethlehem and they head for the land of Moab. Now, Moab was one of those nations that had been attacking Israel. So they're kind of an enemy of Israel. They worship other gods. And according to the law in Deuteronomy, it says no Moabite or his children were allowed to enter the assembly of the Lord up to the 10th generation. They were not liked by the Israelites. So basically, this wasn't a great thing. Elimelech had left the people of God and the place of worship. But during that time, Elimelech dies, his sons marry Moabite women, and then those two sons die. And so you've got Naomi left from this whole family that traveled to Moab. You've got Naomi left on her own with two daughters-in-laws, these three widows. Widows in ancient Near Eastern culture were almost always incredibly poor. They were destitute. In that, women in that society were completely dependent on their husbands and their sons, and with all three men dead and no extended family in Moab, they found themselves in this incredibly vulnerable position. Then Naomi hears that the famine has ended, and so she decides to return home to Bethlehem, and with such selfless love for her daughters-in-law, she basically urges them to stay. She urges them to stay in Moab, to return to their family, because they were young, they had their whole futures ahead of them, they could remarry, they could have children, they could have a land, they had a future ahead of them. It was different for Naomi. And Orpah, who's one of the daughters-in-law, she agrees, but Ruth refuses. So even though she can expect nothing from Naomi, Ruth insists that she stays. Now, Nick has been an absolute star and hopefully has put up some Bible verses. So it's Ruth 1, 15 to 18. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. A beautiful passage of Ruth's commitment to her mother-in-law. So they go on this journey. They go back. They head back to Bethlehem. It would have been a long and a dangerous journey, particularly for two women traveling on their own, particularly because Naomi is an older woman. But they arrive in Bethlehem weary, empty, with no home and no security. But Ruth quickly steps up. She takes care of her mother-in-law, and she relies on this Israelite law that made provision for the poor, for the widow, for the orphan, and for the foreigner, where the poor were allowed to glean behind the harvester to collect food for themselves. If you're unfamiliar with that term, it basically means that God commanded that landowners, they didn't harvest the corners of their field. They didn't go over a second time to get everything they can. It wasn't like God was saying, don't be efficient in your harvesting, so that the poor can come after you and can pick up whatever you've left behind. So God made a way for the poor to be provided for. And unbeknown to Ruth, she ends up working in a field belonging to Boaz, a wealthy and respected landowner who just happens to be a near relation of Elimelech. Now, Boaz treats her with incredible generosity, and when Naomi hears that it's his field that Ruth is working in, hope is restored to her, like for the first time. It's a bit of a turning point in the book, because it fills her with hope, because Boaz is a kinsman redeemer. I don't know if you know that term or not, but Alistair McGrath basically describes, he's a famous theologian, he describes a kinsman redeemer was a relative who had the privilege or duty to restore or preserve the full community rights of family members who had fallen on difficult times. The word redeem means buy back. It included the responsibility of redeeming family land where this had to be sold, redeeming enslaved family members, and providing an heir for the family. Now, the most likely situation of what happens in Ruth is that Elimelech sold his land before leaving for Moab. Naomi would have had retained the rights to buy it back, thus keeping it in the family. However, lacking the funds to do so, she is dependent upon someone in the family buying it back on her behalf. Without this redemption, she cannot possess the land to which she has rights or benefit from it in any way. So you get the feeling of that kinsman redeemer that buys back what has been lost for a family member. It described quite a lot about buying back the land, but it's important to know it's also about the heir. You know, the family line was really, really important. And for Ruth and Orpah, they didn't have any children. So for Naomi, there was no family line. And that was a terrible thing within that society. So Naomi basically hatches this plan to ask Boaz to be Ruth's kinsman redeemer. All under Naomi's instruction, Ruth puts on her best clothes, puts on her perfume, she does, it says that in the Bible, and goes out to the threshing floor in the middle of the night where Boaz is sleeping. She uncovers his feet, lies down at his feet, and goes to sleep there. And when he wakes, she basically asks him to spread the corner of his garment over her, because you are my kinsman redeemer. That picture of covering her with his garment, the whole thing sounds very forward, doesn't it? And it basically is. She is asking for him to marry her, is the summing up of the situation. But the corner of the wings, at the corner of his garment, the word corner is quite often linked to wings, but it's basically a sign of protection. She's basically saying, will you cover me with your protection? That's what's going on there. Boaz says that he is willing. he seems quite happy with the situation. And then Ruth basically has to wait again as there's one more obstacle because there is a kinsman redeemer that is nearer, a closer kin basically to Elimelech. And anyway, he says no. And so Boaz can go on to redeem the land, to marry Ruth. They have a child called Obed. They have an heir to the name of for Naomi and Elimelech. And all is well. It's all great. But today, so that's the end of the story. Today, I just wanted to focus on one verse that I think summarizes Ruth's heroism. It's Ruth 2, verses 11 to 12, where Boaz basically speaks to her, and he says, "May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Under whose wings you have come to take refuge. I think that is a beautiful, poetic picture of someone coming to trust the Lord, coming to place their whole selves under his protection, coming under his wings. And wings are a metaphor often used in the Bible to communicate the protective outreach of God's power, his loving protection. You can see it right the way throughout Scripture. It's too many times that I could recount to you, but I loved Psalm 91, the beginning of which it says, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness will be your shield and your rampart." So Ruth has basically placed her full trust in God, in Yahweh. She's placed herself under the protection of God. She places her trust in him. And I guess what I wanted to do today is because I think that for all of us, this issue of will we trust God is the ongoing lesson, I feel, of life. Will we trust God with our futures? Will we trust God with our situations that we find ourselves? Will we trust God even in the terrible times that sometimes come along, just as was with Ruth and Naomi? And the question that I want to ask is, what characterizes Ruth's faith? What did Boaz see in her that he identified that this was a noble woman, that this was a woman of faith? And I just want to mention three things quickly. The first thing is that she's willing to let go. Ruth had a choice. She could stay in Moab or she could commit herself to Ruth and to Ruth's God. Commit herself to Naomi. And in that beautiful passage that I read earlier, Ruth chooses Naomi, but that means letting go. And sometimes when we place ourselves and we trust God for our futures, that means that we have to let go of stuff. Some things, desires for our future, some plans for our lives, some things when we come to realize maybe this isn't God's best for the future, sometimes God asks us to say goodbye before we get to step into what God has got for us. For me, I remember in my early 20s, I went out with an amazing guy for a very long time, over four years. And we adored each other. But it came, as time went on, it basically became clear that actually we were going in slightly different directions, that actually it probably wasn't the best thing for us to continue going out. And so we had this whole thing, you may have been there, where you're like, we need to break up. And then you break up and you walk away and then you go and you get back together. And then, no, we got to break up. And then you get back together and break up and get back together. It happened a number of times. I was that person. But it basically got to that point where we were just like, this has got to stop. We've got to make a choice. We've got to make a choice. And sometimes you've got to let go to be able to step into what God has for you. And it is the most painful thing. If you've been there, it is horrible to let go of something, especially when you can picture your whole future ahead of you. And sometimes you need to say, that's not the right way for me. I need to let go and be prepared to trust God for the future, even though I don't know what that means. And that was a situation for Ruth. She lived in Moab. She had the familiarity around her. She knew what life looked like there. But she had to make, in that moment, the decision, was she going to cling on to what was not God's best for her? Or was she going to trust him for the future, let go, and commit herself to Ruth? And that's what she did. connected. Faith in God always involves a letting go of other things. You know, everyone places their trust in something, don't they? Everyone does. Whether it's in education or finances or jobs or your plan for your life or your wit or whatever it may be, we trust things to secure our future and to give us hope for the future. And all of those things are great things. But God demands first place. God says, you know, he needs to be above it all. And sometimes that means letting go. It means submitting. Trust in God and something else doesn't work. God needs to be above it all. And we see with Ruth that there was none of this kind of, am I going to compromise? Am I going to go one way and then the other? Ruth was all in. She was no holding back, no escape path in case things go wrong. And Ruth says that no matter what we face, I'm with you, even if that means death. She had no idea what the future held for them, and yet she says, I'm in. That commitment to go with what God had. And I guess one of the questions that I want to ask us is, are you 100% in? Are there areas of your life that you're still, whilst following God, keeping away from him? Because that's too much to let go. Is there any part that you're holding back? Do you really believe that if you trust God, that he can secure your future better than if you did it on your own? His desire for your future goes beyond what you desire. You can trust him. So firstly, she was willing to let go. Secondly, she submitted to God's provision. God had made a way for her to be provided for, and she did it. You know, this whole law that the Israelites were gleaning, she did that thing. Now, ultimately, it was picking up other people's leftovers. It might not be the ideal thing, and yet God had provided for her. She didn't succumb to self-pity. She didn't succumb to bitterness or playing the victim. She took initiative. She worked hard, and she worked hard with utter humility. And sometimes God's provision for us, it might not be the ideal. Might be sometimes a stepping stone. Sometimes we don't see the end of the story. But maybe where God has led us, if God has led you there, work faithfully there, because it's not the end of the story. God will continue to lead you on. But faith doesn't mean that we don't have to do anything. Faith is not contrary to work. God's provision often includes our action. We do our bit and he does his, and usually that is a very good deal. So secondly, she submits to God's provision. Thirdly, she looks out for the needs of others above herself. If you're feeling insecure about your future, if you're not sure that you can wholly trust that God has got you, and insecurity and fear creeps on, that emotion of fear naturally places us in survival mode. You know, that sense of, I've got to look after me, I've got to hold on to what I've got. Whereas when you fully trust God, that he has got your future, you're free to think of others and their needs. Ruth consistently put the needs of Naomi above herself. She could have provided herself a future. She probably could have gone and find herself a husband. She could have had children. She could have been secure. But that wouldn't have taken care of Naomi. She thought of others before herself. So in these three ways, I think Ruth's faith and her complete trust, her all into God and his ways and his purposes, is made clear. But behind that, what do we see about God? What is God doing while Ruth is trusting in him? Well, on first look through the story, God appears actually not to be that present. He doesn't speak. He's just spoken about. He doesn't appear to do anything. There's no miraculous intervention. But as you take a closer look, the biblical writer reveals the presence, the protection, and the provision of God in the beautiful subtleties of language. His first provision is in Ruth. You know, I don't know if Naomi could have made it by herself. Could she have traveled that distance from Moab to Bethlehem without the companionship of Ruth? Could she, an old grief-stricken widow, had to have gleaned herself? Would her morale or even her body have held up to that kind of test? I'm not sure. But Ruth's presence would have given her hope that life beyond tragedy was possible. And there are some journeys that we're not meant to take on our own. God has given us each other. We're meant to give each other hope. We are there to encourage each other when someone feels like giving up. We're meant to travel further together, do more together, endure more together, achieve more together. And if in any way that you've believed the lie that you need to be independent or that you should be strong enough, that you don't want to be a burden or that your problems are yours alone, can I tell you respectfully that I think you're wrong? I don't think that's what the Bible has for us. Life was not created to be lived alone. God is community in his very self, that three in one. You know, we're made in his image and we reflect him in our togetherness. If there's any point at the moment where you're in a place of struggle, if you're struggling in your marriage, you're not meant to walk that on your own. If you are struggling with a health problem or drinking too much or an addiction, or if you've got mild postnatal depression or stressed at work or grieving the death of someone that's close to you, those things, we're not meant to walk on our own. You know, life does contain tragedy and pain and crisis. Those things are normal. We'll all face it, hopefully at different times. But God has given us each other, first and foremostly, to help us get through. In this last season, I cannot tell you how grateful I've been to the staff team as we've walked these last few months where we've had to say some precious goodbyes to some precious friends, where we've said goodbye to York House, where we've stood in the gap between having God's provision and waiting for his next provision, when the future doesn't look all clear, it's not all worked out. And in that time, we've prayed together, we've listened together, we've discerned together, we've supported one another, we've had our wobbles at different times, and we've encouraged each other. And just that sense of together we can trust that God is in these things, and that he's in control, that he's the one that builds his church, and that he molds and directs us as he sees fit. There has been a joy in the togetherness as you go through uncertainty. For many of us, God has given you people in this room to walk with you through life. They have known your challenges intimately. And for many of you, their names might spring to mind straight away. And if that's the case for you, I just wanted to encourage you again that that's God's gift. That's God's gift to you. Thank God for them. And for others of you, I think probably maybe you ache for that kind of relationship. And I pray that you'd find it here. And I'm not saying that I'm a pro in friendship in any way whatsoever. I fail at this stuff all the time. But could a first step be that you give yourself in friendship that you will receive? That as you give yourself in friendship, you'll receive. You know, maybe ask God, who needs encouragement? Who needs someone to ask how their day was and to give them time to give a full answer and to listen intently? Who needs an invitation for a coffee or a drink out? It starts with the walking alongside someone starts with the simple things. See who comes to mind. You could be someone else's Ruth. And as we see from the passage and this whole story, there is great reward and there's blessing in committing yourself to someone else for their benefit, to give yourself for their dreams, to give yourself to help them get through. So first, provision is in the person of Ruth. Secondly, we see God orchestrating details and timings in his divine providence. There's loads of different things I can mention here, but if you have a quick look at chapter 1, verse 22, it says, so Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. I love that. As the barley harvest was beginning. Not a few weeks later when it had all finished. Not a few weeks earlier when they would have come and they would have had no means to provide for themselves. They arrived in the perfect time. God's got perfect timing, and sometimes he intervenes in that kind of way. Was it coincidence or was it God's providence? Or chapter 2, verse 3. As it turns out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Now, Ruth could have walked into any field. Every family would have had land of their own. She could have walked into any field on that day, and yet she just happened to walk into the field of Boaz. Coincidence or God's providence? You see God's hand at work in the Lord's laws written years previously that allowed the poor to provide for themselves through gleaning the corners of the field. You see him in the laws that provide a kinsman redeemer for the widow. You see him in, as those laws are faithfully obeyed at a time when people were doing whatever they thought was right in their own eyes. As you look closer at the book of Ruth, you see a God who has gone before them and already put things in place for their redemption and their freedom and their fullness of life. A God who is orchestrating details and circumstances and timings when they're not even aware to restore and bless and bring about his purposes. Romans 8 verse 28 repeats that kind of theme. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. That's what he does. That's what he does in our lives. It's not that we don't go through times of suffering, but in all things, God can work for the good of those who love him. I'm regularly amazed at God's ability and willingness to step into the detail of our lives. For us, one situation that I remember a few years ago, we moved into a flat just north of here, next to the Bemerton Estate, to the left of Caledonian Road, just next to York Way. And we were really excited about living there. But as we kind of first looked around, there was still a little bit of nervousness where we were like, will anyone come and see us here? Will, you know, friends from school or friends from church, will they walk to the other side of Caledonian Road, come through, and will they come and visit, or will we be on our own? A little bit of that, just a little niggle. And on the day that our rental offer was accepted, we had some very dear friends over for dinner, Andy and Lucy Clasper, who are here somewhere. And as the evening went on, they told us that they had some exciting news, that on that very day, they had put in an offer to buy a flat on the redevelopment of King's Cross. It was off York Way. In fact, it was just opposite our flat. We've spent the last few years knowing when each other are in or out because we can see the light on each other's windows. The sense of God in that moment, when both of us, to be honest, were excited that God was calling us there, but also a little bit nervous. In that one evening, God confirmed, I'm in this, you can trust me, just because of the timing. That one timing. We could have had dinner with anyone, but we had dinner with them on that very day. There's a beautiful quote from a guy called Alexander Michael who says, knowing that I am not the one in control gives great encouragement. Knowing the one who is in control is everything. Knowing the one who is in control is everything. At the end of Ruth, it finishes in chapter 4, verse 13. The women said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and cared for him. The women living there said, Naomi has a son, and they called him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So the end of this story, we see that Ruth, this poor widow, the Moabitess, the foreigner who was brought up worshipping other gods, becomes the great-grandmother of David, the greatest king in the whole of Israel. And then from the line of David comes Jesus himself. You know, at the beginning of Matthew's gospel, Ruth is one of the few women that is named in the genealogy of Jesus. The blessings of God were always intended to extend beyond Israel. The people of Israel were blessed to be a blessing. That was always God's intention, through whom all people on earth would be blessed, would know God. But Ruth's presence in the genealogy of Jesus confirms that fact. God was doing so much more than providing for this one woman. He was bringing about his purposes in the world around her, and she had no idea. Faith, not Hebrew blood, declares that you are chosen by God. And as I mentioned earlier, the Moabites were excluded from the assembly of God to the 10th generation. Well, that kind of failed, because three generations from Ruth came the worshipper king that wrote the majority of the psalms that were worshipped in the assembly of God. Four generations from Ruth came the man who not only entered the assembly, he built the assembly, he built the temple of God. what the law did not allow, grace made a way for. We have a beautiful story of redemption. We could go on to talk about how that Boaz is a picture of Jesus to come, who is our Redeemer, who brought us back. There is so much within this beautiful, beautiful story, but I wanted to concentrate on Ruth's faith and God behind the scenes working to bring about his purposes and working to bring about his goodness and provision and life for this family. I love that these stories are in the Bible. If I look at my life, not much of it are the glory moments. They're not the moments when history has changed. Like some of the other heroes that we read about in the Old Testament, my life doesn't look too much like them. It's mundane, it's normal, it's everyday. Sometimes it seems insignificant. But God's little becomes part of God's, Ruth's little becomes part of God's big story in a way far beyond her understanding. And I wanted to say that God's doing the same with us. He's bringing about his purposes. He's bringing about his kingdom through us. That's what he wants to do. As we submit our lives to him, as we let go, as we are faithful to trust the provision that God has got for us, and as we look beyond our own needs to the needs of others around us, God's blessing comes. He is faithful to provide. His future for you is good. You can trust him. Why don't we stand?